People in the police department are angry regarding these allegations.
An Anchorage police officer is arrested on sexual assault charges. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 15th of July. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Bethel bans a common grocery store nuisance.
There's so much plastic bags, you fly out here, you'll see them all over.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
An Anchorage police officer is being accused of 10 counts of sexual assault. Anthony Rollins was taken into custody today after a three-month investigation uncovered six potential victims. The investigation began on April 16th when a staff member at Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, reported information about an alleged assault by Rollins while he was on duty. Anchorage Police Chief Rob Hewen says special investigators found five other potential victims, but more could still surface.
We went back through all of his contacts that we could find. It is still ongoing. Let me remind everyone, there's no statute of limitations on the sexual assault. So we expect that as we continue this investigation, there's a chance there might be other victims. That is something that the investigation will play out.
Rollins has been with the Anchorage Police for 13 years. He has served as a patrol officer, a police spokesperson, and a canine officer. He allegedly committed the first sexual assault 3 years ago. Police Chief Hewen says the police collaborated with the state and with the FBI during the investigation. He says police officers should always be held to a high standard, and he is confident justice will be served in this case.
Let me stress that Rollins' alleged actions are aberrant and detestable. Officers are compelled to function independently within the confines of the laws they are sworn to uphold and have the authority to enforce. They are and should be trusted.
The executive director of STAR is praising the way the Anchorage police have handled Rollins' case. Nancy Haig says investigating officers have been diligent, responsive, and respectful. She says, unfortunately, cases where public officials take advantage of their positions of power are too common.
I know I hold law enforcement officers to a standard of where they would be law-abiding citizens and helping to protect us as opposed to putting us at risk. So this is particularly, I think, particularly difficult for the community to know that this has been going on by an officer that we would hope would be upholding the law.
Haig says it's always difficult for survivors of sexual assault to come forward and report the crime, but it may be especially difficult in a case like this. She says the community owes a debt of gratitude to each survivor who speaks up. A Senate subcommittee will hold a hearing tomorrow in Washington on Alaska Native corporations and the advantages they get through a Small Business Administration program. The Subcommittee on Contracting Oversight will take testimony from government workers involved in the program, as well as national Native business organizations. However, no one representing Alaska Native corporations has been invited to testify. Many Alaskans plan to attend tomorrow's hearing anyway, including Helvi Sandvik, who serves as president of Nana Development Corporation, the business arm of Nana Regional Corporation, which serves the Inupiat of Northwest Alaska. Nana is part of a coalition that formed this week to promote the Small Business Administration's 8A program. The group, called Native 8A Works, wants to get its message to Congress. Nana and 19 other Native corporations have turned over their financial information to the Senate subcommittee in preparation for tomorrow's hearing. Sandvik says she hopes the corporations will have a chance to share their perspective at some point.
The concern I have is the context in which the data is presented, and you know, I would love an opportunity to explain who we are as an Alaska Native Corporation. I'm not sure there is a great deal of understanding about ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the purpose of ANCSA, the fact that this particular program that we participate in and some of the opportunities that we are able to become engaged, it's not limited to Alaska Native corporations.
Sandvik says the same rules apply to Lower 48 Indian tribes and Hawaiian organizations. The Small Business Administration 8A program also gives Native groups extra advantages beyond other small minority-owned businesses, but Sandvik says that's because the Native groups each represent large numbers of people and face unique challenges. Another benefit is that while other groups mature out of Small Business Administration programs, Native corporations aren't limited. Sandvik says that's because they have to overcome numerous disadvantages.
In order for us to feel as though we're in a position to guarantee not just today's generations of Nana shareholders, but future generations of Nana shareholders will be able to continue our cultural lifestyle as well as to be a part of the broader U.S. economy and the benefits and the services that are available to other U.S. citizens. We have huge hurdles to overcome before I would feel comfortable saying enough is enough.
Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri called tomorrow's hearing and has asked why Native corporations are afforded so many opportunities. She has also raised questions about whether the government is getting the best deal through the contracts. Sandvik says the contracts are fair and Nana follows through.
The real question, I believe, Senator McCaskill is interested in is whether or not these companies are offering good value to the government through their services. And I would say unequivocally, yes. We are working hard. We're following the rules of the program.
Sandvik says while the number of government contracts with Alaska Native corporations has skyrocketed in recent years, government contracts have also increased in number across the board. Alaska senators plan to attend tomorrow's hearing to support the program. It's been debated for years, but on Tuesday, the Bethel City Council finally did it. The council voted to ban plastic bags and styrofoam containers. The ban is aimed at grocery stores and restaurants. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
They're convenient, they're cheap, and soon they'll be illegal. They're non-biodegradable plastic bags, and Bethel residents use a lot of them. That's according to Trevin Prince. He's a cashier at Bethel's largest grocery store, owned by the Alaska Commercial Company. As he checks out a customer, he pulls out a new stack of 40 bags.
At my shift, we go through about six of those.
Prince estimates that he alone goes through about 240 bags in an eight-hour shift. That means thousands of plastic bags are distributed in Bethel each day, and many of those will not come to rest in Bethel's landfill.
There's so much plastic bags, you fly out here, you'll see them all over.
Harry Morgan is an Aniak resident shopping at AC. He says Aniak already banned plastic bags, and he's happy to see Bethel do the same.
The big change was all the plastic bags weren't all over town, you know, and all these other villages I go to, I see plastic bags all over around town. So that's pretty sad. So it would be good to ban these plastic bags here.
Councilmember Beverly Hoffman was the sponsor of the ban. The issue has been raised several times over the years, but failed to garner enough political support. But Hoffman says there are now more biodegradable options.
All public testimony was in support of the ban. The new ban will not outlaw the possession of plastic bags, but will make it illegal for grocery stores to offer non-biodegradable plastic bags at checkout counters. It will also make it illegal for restaurants to use styrofoam takeout containers. The new ordinance does allow for the use of reusable bags, paper bags, and biodegradable plastic bags. The ban will go into effect in September of 2010. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, zeroing in on the cause of falling sea lion populations in Alaska.
Natality rates are down about 30-35% from what they were in the 70s.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by STEMS Floral Artistry and Gifts for Giving. STEMS in Anchorage at 563-3366. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The Alaska Legislature will meet in a special session to consider overriding Governor Sarah Palin's veto of federal stimulus funds for energy-related projects. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak, says the one-day session will be held in Anchorage on August 10th. Besides the veto override vote, Stevens says also on the agenda will be confirming the new lieutenant governor. Current Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell will become governor on July 26th with Palin's planned resignation. Parnell has named Military and Veterans Affairs Commissioner Craig Campbell to replace him on a temporary basis, serving in that capacity until confirmed by the legislature. A controversial bill delaying strict cruise ship wastewater discharge requirements has quietly become law. Governor Sarah Palin signed the measure last week without ceremony or public announcement. The bill gives the big ships until the year 2015 to improve onboard pollution control measures. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The measure started out as a permanent change in the way environmental officials measure pollutants, such as ammonia and dissolved metals. The industry said it already improved discharge standards, and it could not meet stricter requirements set by a voter-approved initiative. But the legislature balked at that idea, which critics said would allow contaminants to damage fish stocks and other marine life. Denise Koch runs the State Department of Environmental Conservation's cruise ship program.
Without this law, next cruise ship season, during the 2010 season, the ships would have had to meet those standards at the point of discharge, at the end of pipe. What this bill does is it essentially allows cruise ships more time to come into compliance with the long-term water quality standards.
Ships now have until 2015 to meet the stronger standards. Officials hope that allows them to find or develop equipment that can meet the new discharge limits. A state seminar earlier this year identified some promising technologies, but it may not fit on ships. The industry could get some help from the state. The bill sets up an 11-member science advisory group.
This panel is going to assist DEC in trying to answer this question and trying to assess and report on the effectiveness of wastewater technology and trying to get at that question of what is economically and feasible and technologically effective wastewater treatment systems that we can expect for cruise ships to have on ships.
The bill also calls for new discharge permits, which will be good for 3 rather than 5 years. Permit details will go out for comment this fall. Koch says the state continues to enforce interim discharge limits. It's already sent 6 notices of violation to ships that have exceeded standards this year. Valdez Republican Representative John Harris sponsored the bill. He says he expected it to change during the legislative process.
You know, it's a fairly controversial issue, and they're having a hard time finding somebody. And so I said I would do it because I want the industry to continue to provide jobs and business in Alaska. But I also stipulated that I wasn't going to try to ramrod something through that would be detrimental to the environment in Alaska.
The industry accepted the final compromise. Alaska Cruise Association staff could not be reached for immediate comment, but representatives have said their discharges are already cleaner than most municipal and shore-based industrial systems in the state. Cruise critic Gershon Cohen takes another view. He says cruise lines have been trying to get too much leeway.
You know, the industry's goal when at the beginning of the session was to eliminate the mixing zone ban for cruise ship discharge, and that was something that they were not able to achieve. I'm happy to say the legislature held firm on that and said, no, the people of the state voted for this, and they want this in place, and we're going to continue this.
33 cruise ships are sailing Alaska waters this season. Officials say only about half are using wastewater discharge permits. The others store their wastewater and release it outside state boundaries. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The price tag for a highway out of Juneau has risen $100 million in 2 years, according to the State Transportation Department. DOT's new estimate for the road, ferry, and terminal is $449 million. The department's most recent estimate in October of 2007 was $350 million. The preferred alternative for the 50-mile route runs from Echo Cove to the Katsihin River, where a ferry terminal would be built. Project manager Ruben Yost describes the increase to inflation and to recent findings about an area known as Zone 4. The new information comes from the Golder Report, a geotechnical study commissioned by the department.
Zone 4 is the segment from basically just south of Comet, Sweeney Creek, up to the Katsihin River. And those costs went up, in our estimate, about 82%. We met with Golder representatives in November and December, and that led to the inclusion of two tunnel segments and several additional bridges. We also had areas where rather than cutting into the hillside, we build below a problem area and build retaining walls to retain the fill.
Yost expects rising inflation to increase costs further, but he says DOT will not calculate another estimate until a federal court rules on an appeal of a requirement to conduct additional environmental impact statements on the proposed road.
The selected alternative is essentially placed on hold, given the fact that the judge vacated the Federal Highway's record of decision. So, you know, the state has filed a notice of appeal of the district court's decision. So the next step is for the Ninth Circuit to rule on whether or not the EIS was adequate.
Meanwhile, an independent estimate by the Federal Highway Administration's Western Federal Lands Highway Division sets the project cost at $491 million. Yost calls the less than 10% difference between that estimate and DOT's estimate insignificant. If anything, he says it suggests, quote, that neither estimate is way out of line. Lois Epstein, director of Anchorage-based watchdog group, the Alaska Transportation Priorities Project, begs to differ.
All along, watchdog organizations have been saying, you know, you need to look at all these serious geotechnical hazards, rockfall potential, landslides, avalanches. You need to consider whether tunnels are needed. And now DOT has said they are needed. We would contend that potentially they are still underestimating the cost. We need to know what a worst-case number is going to be, not just a lowball number. And I fear that's what we have right now.
Epstein says that the independent Zone 4 estimate was based on a per-mile cost rather than on design costs. She says a per-mile estimate is much less accurate than a design-based estimate and can lead to an underestimate of overall project costs.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The National Marine Fisheries Service is continuing their research on stellar sea lions this summer. This time, they are using high-resolution aerial photography to count the number of pups at rookeries and haulouts from Sitka to the Western Aleutians. Biologist Lowell Fritz says they need to take the photos now before the pups start swimming with their mothers. This year's survey is aided by new technology.
Cameras are attached to a mount that actually compensates for the forward motion of the plane, and it so that the image is perfectly still, as if you were on a non-moving platform, and it slightly rotates, and it also will take the pictures quick enough so that you get this overlap. So between the rocking motion and the overlap, you get an entire swath of the beach, and they're perfectly crystal clear, as if you were standing on a, you know, or using a tripod.
With crisp images, biologists can more distinctly see the animals. Fritz says in older surveys, it was sometimes hard to distinguish between pups and rocks. The survey started on June 24th, and it took only 5 days to go from Sitka to Unalaska. Then the crew was stuck in Adak for over a week because of bad weather. They were also unable to survey the far western Aleutians, where sea lion populations are having the worst problems. Unlike in other parts of western Alaska, their numbers never rebounded in the early 2000s. The NIMS sea lion research focuses on juveniles and adults some years, but those age groups seem to be healthy with high survival levels.
With survival being high and we're not seeing any real rebound in the population, what we think is an impediment to recovery is pup production. And it does, from our modeling, it looks as though pup natality rates are down about 30-35% from what they were in the 70s. And this is why we're continuing to study this, because at this point we don't know exactly why this pup production rate is going down.
Fritz says they need to study adult females to find out why they aren't reproducing, and next year's research will focus on that. Currently, scientists have three different theories on why birth rates are low. The first two, disease outbreaks and environmental contaminants and pollutants, don't have much evidence supporting them, but Fritz says they need to look into the contaminants theory harder.
And the third thing that could cause a drop in natality would be some sort of nutritional stress. Such like from environmental changes or competition with fishing.
Researchers are also looking at sea lion scat to learn what different populations of sea lions are eating and how that's changing. They want to know if diet diversity affects survival or health. Fritz says they need to understand the physiology of females as well, because the overall population survival depends on their reproductive success.
In order to get recovery in the population, we're going to need to see an improvement in the birth rates. So right now, the stability that we're seeing in the population, or even some of the increases, is almost entirely due to better survival than we've had in the past.
In addition to doing aerial surveys of sea lions, Fritz's team is also taking photos of the fur seal rookeries in the Pribilof Islands. Aerial surveys of the fur seals started 80 years ago and have continued on 20-year cycles. Officials from the Forest Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are warning visitors to beware of increased brown bear activity at Redoubt Lake south of Sitka. KCAW's Emily Schwing reports.
Reports of three bears, a male nicknamed Sly and a sow nicknamed Mama Bear, as well as her cub, have increased in recent days. Perry Edwards manages the fish weir at Redoubt Lake for the U.S. Forest Service.
I've gotten a number of reports from the crew out there and from some other folks out there that the sow and the cub, some people are trying to get a good photograph of it, and the sow false charged people because they got a little bit too close.
Agency officials say the potential for bears to become habituated to humans is a large concern, especially because both Forest Service and Fish and Game employees have been working at the weir on a daily basis this summer. Edwards says there have been confirmed reports that the male bear has taken fish from fishermen.
People have been fishing out there, and all it takes is a few people to lay a big pile of fish down when they're netting. They get excited, and there's four or five fish laying there, and the bears see that as a really easy opportunity, and so they're going to take advantage of that opportunity, especially sly, which got the name for just that reason. It's really good at sneaking out from the bushes when people aren't looking and grabbing a fish and taking off with it. The worst thing you can do is reward them by giving them a fish either accidentally or on purpose, trying to get the bear to go away. A fed bear is a dead bear.
The male bear has been fishing at Readout Lake for 4 years. The female has been in the area for the last 2 to 3 years. Edwards says closing the area to visitors or relocating the bears is out of the question. He also says there's no good reason to destroy the bears. Both the Forest Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are asking the public to beware of the bears and to practice bear awareness while fishing in the area.
The whole thing with this is that we want to keep people safe and the bears alive. That's the perfect situation. What we don't want to get into is people, you know, shooting rifles or handguns off, trying to scare the bears. But a lot of people don't realize that there's people working up at the weir on and off all day long and are around in that area 24 hours a day. The other problem we've had is people bring their dogs up and they're not on a leash and the dog's running around, and that's another terrible situation. And this is their turf. This is, you know, we need to remember that they have as much or more right than we do to be there. And I think we just need to learn to get along and to give them their space. And, you know, if those bears are in a fishing spot, you legally are not allowed to push them out of that spot. They have first dibs until they get tired of fishing, then you're welcome to move in and take that spot.
In Sitka, I'm Emily Schwing.
A group of Alaska Native kids from the Anchorage area is exploring Denali National Park this week. The 8 high school students from the Cook Inlet Tribe are participants in a National Parks Foundation-funded program related to the upcoming premiere of Ken Burns' National Parks documentary series that features Denali. Park media specialist Jay Elhard says Denali is one of 35 parks across the country that received grants to get underserved groups into parks.
We have a really good history, obviously, in middle-class communities, if you will, who have it's a great tradition for families to jump in the back of the station wagon and visit national parks in the Great American West, but that's not necessarily the case in a lot of other cultural communities within America. Our great goal of this larger grant project is to have it become more of the fabric of their communities as well.
The kids in the Denali program are spending 4 days traveling and camping along and off the park road. They're meeting with rangers, park specialists, and local Athabascan elders to learn about wildlife, environment, and cultural aspects of the Denali region. Elhard says the teens are set up with video and audio recording equipment to document their experience.
These little pocket camcorders we bought for them to have during their stay here, that they can just sort of record their time in the park as they're hiking around and as they're visiting visitor centers, and then they can use that as raw material to work on their digital stories. And then we also are got a parabolic microphone, one of those big dishes that you see on the side of football fields, for instance, that we're hoping that the kids will be able to pick up natural sounds.
Elhard says the kids will take the material they record back to Anchorage, where they'll be working with a local Native media lab to produce videos for possible screening in conjunction with the September premiere of Ken Burns' documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Elhard says the hope is to get a follow-up grant to continue the program with kids from other areas of the state. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld and Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company,
and by
the new AT&T, your world delivered. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.